August meeting of the Tucson Supplemental Retirement System Board of Trustees. Art, would you call the roll, please?
Sure, Mark.
Here.
Kevin.
Here.
Jim.
Here.
Jeff.
Here.
Aaron.
Here.
Elsa. I don't see Elsa. We have a quorum, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We have a request from Lanny Vitek to take her disability matter out of order. Is Ms. Benjamin on the phone or on the call? All right.
I don't see her yet, Mark.
Yeah.
And I don't see Lanny either. So.
Okay.
I see Lanny with her camera off and her microphone muted.
There she is.
Ms. Dcheck, are you here?
Right, Mike.
Ms. Dcheck, are you here?
Yes, I am. Sorry, I was trying to get my computer to respond. I apologize.
Okay. All right. We are going to take.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
We're going to take the Dcheck matter out of order. So I guess we need a motion to go into executive session.
Mark, Mr. Chairman, before we do that, do you want to go through? Do you want to have the consent agenda approved? Or are we going to take it completely out of order?
Sure. Okay. Do I hear a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
So moved. This is Kevin.
Okay. Is there any discussion about any items? Anybody notice anything that's an issue or otherwise needs to be called to our attention? All right. Art, would you call the roll on the vote for the consent agenda?
Yeah, Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jeff.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Motion passes 5-0.
Okay. We need a vote then to go into executive session, correct?
That's the board's pleasure.
Yes. Okay. Do I hear a motion to move into executive session for the Dcheck matter?
So moved. This is Jeff.
Second, by Kevin.
All right, thank you. Art, call the roll, please.
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Jeff.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
And motion passes 5-0. Those were invited. We'll jump over to the executive session.
And close yourselves out of this matter, please. All right. Do I hear a motion to return to regular session?
Hold on, Mark. We don't have a quorum.
Oh. Who'd we lose?
I need Kevin. Jim and Kevin.
Yeah. All right. Hope they return. Kevin's here. Where's Jim?
I don't know, but sometimes it takes him a minute. It takes Jim a minute to get back on. Jeff Whiting had to leave. Yes, we need Jim. Jeff Whiting had to leave to another meeting, so we need Jim.
Okay.
Hello.
Jim, is that you who just joined?
This is Jim joining by telephone.
Okay.
All right. Do we have a motion to return to regular session?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Yes. All right. Art, would you call the vote? Please.
Call the roll. Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Oh, we need to do.
Okay. Yeah, it's a roll call. Kevin.
Okay. Here.
Aaron.
Here.
Jim.
Aye.
Okay, there's a quorum.
Okay. Let's back up then. Do we have a motion to return to regular session?
Yes, yeah, so moved.
Okay. We have a second.
I'll second.
Okay. Call the vote, please.
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Jim.
I lost the motion. Would you repeat it?
It's just to resume regular session.
Oh, yes, aye.
Motion passes 4-0.
All right. Do we have a motion regarding the e-check matter? And I want to remind everybody, we were in executive session. Please be mindful in any discussion we have not to disclose anything that was addressed in executive session. Do we have a motion?
So moved, Jim.
But, Jim, there is no motion on the table.
Oh, sorry.
All right, Chair, I'll make a motion. I think for us to be consistent with our application and history of how we've applied the code language regarding permanent and total disability, as well as other provisions of the code, that we should notify the candidate that as of October 1st, if they're still gainfully employed or employed as they are, that they will lose their disability benefit.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, Art, would you call the vote, please?
Art.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Motion passes 4-0.
All right. Thank you very much. We are now, thank you for your patience, Ms. Benjamin. We are now ready to take up your matter. We need a motion to move to executive session, however. Is there a motion to move to? Yes.
Give me a second. We can take the motion, but I got to get her back on the phone because she's not here.
I'm sorry. I saw the call and thought that was her. It's not. Okay. Can we get her back on the phone?
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Okay. Thanks. Ms. Dietrich, you have a question?
I do. Excuse me. So I guess I should put my camera on. I'm sorry. So what's required of me forward? Is that something you can discuss right now, or is that something?
You need to talk with staff about that, whoever you're working with. Okay? All right?
Okay.
Yeah. We're not going to discuss that in open session. Thanks.
Okay.
And you are welcome to stay in this meeting, although we're going to be likely moving to executive session very shortly, or you can get on with your day. I understood you had an appointment, so.
Yes, I do.
Go forth.
I appreciate you linking me in early. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're working on getting Ms. Benjamin back.
Okay.
We can take the motion to move into executive session now, move into executive session, and
get her to an executive
session. Yeah.
Okay. Is there a motion to move to executive session?
So moved, Ms. Kevin.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay.
Mark, see you guys over there, please.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Motion passes 4-0. Okay. We'll see you in the exec session.
We'll see you all in a So, Art, was Jim on the executive session call? Because I had an email from him that said he couldn't join it. Was he there? He was.
Yeah, I saw him there. Yeah, his number was there.
Okay. All right. So do we have a quorum now to take a roll call and take a vote on getting back into session while we're waiting for Jim and Ms. Benjamin?
Yes, okay. We do.
All right. Would you call the roll, please?
Sure. Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
I'm here.
Aaron.
Here.
Elsa.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Elsa, thanks for joining us. We're glad you were able to make it. Okay. Do I hear a motion to go back into regular session?
So moved. This is Kevin.
Thank you. Second?
I'll second. This is Elsa.
Okay. Art, would you call the vote, please?
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Motion passes 4-0. Back in regular session.
Okay. We can, well.
I just got off the phone with her, so she should be calling in shortly.
Okay. I guess we'll wait a moment. Gordy, thanks for hanging with us.
No problem.
Ms. Benjamin, is that you?
Yes, yes, I'm here.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go ahead and move forward. Jim can join us when he's able. We're behind time-wise here. Do I hear a motion regarding the Benjamin matter?
All right, Mark, this is Kevin. I will make a motion that we approve the applicant's request for a long-term disability. And my recommendation or my motion is based on the medical findings of our independent doctor, Johnson.
All right, is there a second?
I'll second, Aaron.
Thank you. All right. Any discussion?
I do have a clarification without getting into, of course, medical concerns. I thought we had decided that a indicator for approving some of this would be a confirmation of the Social Security. Or did we get away from that? I think that we had decided on that.
That would be part of the code changes that are pending. Also, Okay. The new language does include what you're referring to.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. That clarifies that for me.
By the way, that doesn't mean that can't be a factor in your thinking at this time. We're simply formalizing that requirement going forward. And in fairness to applicants who filed or are filing before the code change, they're not being told they must apply, but it's a factor in the mix if it mattered to you. All right. Any discussion? Jim, we just had a motion, but there's a motion on the floor to approve, the disability benefit for Ms. Benjamin, just to bring you up to speed. Is there any discussion?
Okay.
All right, Art, would you call the vote, please?
Mark.
Aye.
Kevin.
Aye.
Aaron.
Aye.
Elsa.
Aye.
Jim.
Aye.
Motion passes 5-0. Ms. Benjamin, Pete or Don, whoever you were working with during the course of your application, will be reaching out to finalize the application and your paperwork for disability retirement. Thank you for joining us today.
And thank you, Ms. Benjamin. We all wish you well and hope that having this resolve will assist you in dealing with life. You are free to stay for the rest of the meeting, but you're certainly not expected to, and don't feel like it will matter at all. Your matter is concluded favorably to your application. All right?
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you.
You bet. Good luck going forward. Okay.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right.
Gordy created a note for the quarterly investment review.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having us. Craig is here with me, and Adam Lazinski is joining the call, too, because we have two topics, really. One is performance, and the second is an asset liability study. It's a project that we go through once every 5 years. So we want to spend most of our time on the AL study, and we'll go through performance fairly rapidly, and, of course, are happy to take questions as we go. So I'm going to give just a brief economic summary so you kind of get the backdrop of what's going on with markets and how that applies to the return of TSRS. So just on the first page here, kind of a muddy economic picture with some positives, right? GDP is positive. Consumer spending is still strong. The Fed's efforts to reduce inflation we're seeing it, right? We were at 9% inflation 2 years ago. Now we're now down to 2.9% on CPI through July. And so, those are some good economic indicators. Unemployment is starting to tick up, though. That's sort of expected when you raise interest rates and tighten monetary policy. So we're starting to see unemployment go up. It was 4.3% in July. Also kind of on the negative side, the curve is still inverted. And it's been 2 years that it's been inverted. Usually, if there is a recession during a time when the curve is inverted, it's 18 to 24 months after it's initially has that pattern. So we're kind of at the tail end of that, curve inversion. And then PMI has also been really sluggish. So when we look at manufacturing data, both on the service and the goods side, it's in contractionary territory. So some good, some bad. When we look at returns, though, if you skip ahead two pages, please, Craig, you can see the returns over the last year. They've really been incredible on the equity side. I looked this morning, and over the last year, the S&P 500 is up 30%. So that was through yesterday. So really a tremendous environment for U.S. equity investors. there is a column here where we look at from 2022 to current, and that takes into the impact of that really difficult market we had in 2022 when interest rates went up and equities declined at the same time. And so we're still clawing back in some asset classes, right? So you see the S&P 500 up 7.3. That's been the best they've had. That's the area that's had the best rebound from the 2022 doldrums. But small cap is still negative, down to a little over 2%. Emerging markets are still negative. And, of course, the anchor to windward in your portfolio, that Bloomberg aggregate, is down 3.6% and actually is negative over 5 years. And so we know that's because rates went up pretty severely over the last several years. And now, right, we're in an environment where there are higher yields, higher coupon payments on the bonds, and the Fed seems positioned to lower rates as well at their upcoming meeting. So there's a chance that, we have these higher yields and there's some price appreciation from yields actually coming down a little bit over time. So now if we look at the 10-year column here, really an incredible run for U.S. equities. So you see that 12.2%, that's 34% of your portfolio. And then if you go to the MSCI World ex-USA, that's international equities, 4.3%, that's 24% of your portfolio. And then the aggregate,
think we might have lost Cordy for a second.
Bidding for the day.
Okay, so I'll pick it up.
Thank you.
With where Gordy was, not knowing what exactly he was going to say. But you see the aggregate here over 10 years, 1.4%. You know, I think if we'd looked at that prior to 2022, that was even more paltry because we've been in an interest rate environment that was very low. That makes up about 25% of your portfolio. And then, you know, while it's not a perfect proxy for the real estate allocation that you have, at NCREIF Property Index up 6.1% over that 10-year period. So you see that's falling somewhere in between equity and fixed income. It's one of the reasons that we continue to be, I would say, maybe not bullish is the right term, but supportive of private real estate as an asset class. So before moving on, just want to see if there are any questions on any of the numbers here. Looks like Gordy's back.
Yeah, sorry about that. I don't know what happened. I think I left you on a cliffhanger. The last thing I was going to say is that, you know, the combination of all of your asset classes here, TSRS has returned 6.9%. Your investment management fees over this 10-year period. All right, so that's a good outcome. And you have to remember, you know, 1.4%.
Can you repeat that number? Because you kind of cut out when you were saying it.
Oh, yes. Sorry about that. Maybe I'm having a spotty connection here. 6.9% net over 10 years. And when you have 1.4% from your bonds – at a quarter of the portfolio, that's a really good outcome. So that's it for the market, unless there are questions. I think we'll move to performance.
All right. So looking at numbers here, kind of standard quick review, assets at about $950 million. You can see mostly in line with the target allocations. You do see some slight deviations relative to target. Those are all within investment policy ranges, though. I'm going to flip down another slide. Here, let me blow this up so you can actually see it. I think the big piece to note here is Acadian funded. Over the course of the quarter, the money came from that BlackRock ACWI XUS portfolio. And maybe as a further reminder, that had been the placeholder when, ABRD in Aberdeen, was terminated earlier last year. So that transaction took place. The numbers that Gordy was talking about, you can really see it highlighted there with, $12.7 million of investment earnings over the recent quarter. Pretty consistent with what we tend to see. You do have net outflows, but investment earnings have continued to be pretty strong for the portfolio as a whole. You know, Gordy took a little bit of my thunder talking about final results. You know, you see there over 10 years, 6.9% beating your passively invested policy index. Even over 5 years, up 6.8%. You do see some relative challenges over the, really the 1, 3, and 5 year periods. 2022 was a pretty difficult year for several of your investment managers. And actually, if I go up a slide, you can see this, you know, at least over the last couple of years in a little bit more detail. Champlain, a little bit more specifically, has had some struggles with stock selection, both in healthcare and industrials. Those have been fairly big headwinds for them. They've also been relatively overweight to healthcare, which has been a relative underperformer kind of across the market. They haven't changed investment teams. They haven't changed investment styles. It's just really been I would say more of an unfortunate experience in terms of the holdings that they have underperforming some of that broader index. So while you do see those challenges over that last 3-year period, you can see they're down by about close to 4% relative to the benchmark. They have continued to outperform over that 10-year period and just slightly behind over that 5-year period as well. The other manager that I really wanted to call out here, because I think anytime you see, you know, a negative return, especially for the quarter when the benchmark is up in positive territory, that does raise some eyebrows. American Century, you know, another instance where stock selection for how they invest has been, you know, somewhat counter to the performance that we have seen from the benchmark. So really selection in the consumer areas as well as financials and industrials have produced headwinds. They've also been relatively underweight to Japan. Japan has had a resurgence, maybe not for this recent quarter, but kind of over the last year relative to some other countries. That underweight there has been negatively impactful. This is another story where really silent implementation has caused a headwind, but no recommendations at this stage for us in terms of any changes.
Greg, this is Art.
Go ahead, Art.
With respect to the American Century, how patient should the board be there?
I'm sorry, that was cutting in and out. I don't know if anybody else heard that, but
yeah. Art was asking about you know, how patient should they be? What sort of a time period is appropriate to look at American Century? So when American Century was hired, right, it came with an understanding that they can go in and out of favor, right? And they're very much on the growth side. So if we looked at them and mapped their style, they map very much growth. And some of that has been out of favor on the small cap side internationally, which has been a bit of a headwind for them. But it's a high tracking error product that, again, doesn't look like the benchmark. They're aware of the benchmark. But we've seen periods like this before where they performed on the upside and the downside. So we would suggest a little bit more time. You know, usually we want to see them outperform over 5 years. We're not seeing that here from them. And 7 years is kind of the longest period we would say to give them, because it really covers a full market cycle, or typically covers a full cycle. So we think a little bit more time, but you know, your question is an important one here, Art, because when we look at the asset classes, right, if you can just scroll up a little bit, Craig. You know, we look net of fees, domestic equity, 12.1, your target's at 11.8, right? So there's alpha there. You know, baked into that number is your small and mid-cap U.S. equity. So you can see how well Champlain and FEEM, the Fidelity product, have done over longer periods of time. Right. International equity has been a challenging area. A lot of that was Aberdeen, right? The legacy with Aberdeen there. And of course, American Century plays into that composite over the last 5 years, bringing it down a little bit. So we're focused on that international equity area and trying to improve results there. You know, fixed income implementation has been solid. You see the outperformance over 10 years. And then I think, you know, without stealing the thunder, we know that real estate has been, you know, a problem child. And you can see the numbers over 10 years there, bringing down your attribution. You know, but as Craig mentioned, 2022 is tough for your active managers. You also have, you know, this CPI plus 4 target on your infrastructure. And with CPI, you know, of course, skyrocketing for a period of time, that's been a very difficult benchmark to beat. Right. And so, IFM, your infrastructure manager, has done a good job, but it's been hard for them to keep up with that sort of absolute return oriented bogey.
Thank you. Did that help, Art?
Yeah. Thank you.
And then in the interest of time, the last piece that I did want to cover, was this chart up at the top, and this looks at your fund return relative to if you had been invested in your target and passively invested in all of the asset classes. So even though we do see some hiccups from time to time from a relative performance standpoint, the objective really is to get to your targets and, you know, certainly outperform that passive benchmark over time. And you can see the fund has done that pretty handily over longer periods. So, I was going to stop there. Certainly we wanted, as Gordy said, we wanted to have enough time for Adam to go through the asset liability study for you all to be able to focus on that and ask as many questions as you needed, but certainly happy to take any questions that you have. So with that, I will turn it over to Adam.
Thank you. Thanks, y'all.
Okay, great. Thank you all for having me. Good to see you again, at least virtually. Let's just go to slide 3 and I'll start there. So as you know, we're doing this asset liability project. We've kind of started with my colleague Jay, went over our capital market assumptions, and then we kind of talked about the real estate last time. So now we're kind of wrapping it all up with the full asset liability study, which you do about every 5 years. The last time we did this study was in 2019, and you modestly increased real estate at the time by 3%. Taking 1% from non-US equity and 2% from fixed income. So a small change the last time we did this. Really what we're trying to do here is look at the interaction between assets and liabilities. Typically you do, kind of an asset allocation update once a year, and then every 5 years on this type of cycle, you pull in the liabilities and really take a more in-depth look. And kind of the key decision is, as we see it here, we have on the middle of the page, is, the amount of risk in the portfolio with the way we think about that is the amount allocated to fixed income, because that is your lowest risk diversifying asset class. So, kind of how much fixed income versus other more return seeking, slightly more volatile asset classes do you want to have? I'll just summarize and say before we even get through the rest of it, we think that where you're at is certainly a reasonable place to be. So if you wanted to just reaffirm the allocation that you have, we would certainly support that. And we think if you're going to move to another portfolio, you have a very strong contribution policy and the ability to maybe take some volatility off the table and consider increasing your fixed income allocation. And so we'll talk about that as we go through. But just a couple more things, and then I'll just see if anyone has questions on this introduction. Some key observations to keep in the back of your mind as we go through this study. You have this very strong contribution rate of 27.5% of pay. That's fixed, at least until you get to achieve full funding, and then it kind of reverts, so we'll talk about that. Both your assets and your liabilities are projected to grow, but the asset growth is projected to exceed the liability growth. So that's why I was saying your current mix is certainly a reasonable place to be if you wanted to reaffirm that. The expected return we have for your current mix, based on our capital market assumptions, which I'll show shortly, is 7.3%. And that exceeds your return, your required return, according to your actuarial studies, of 6.75, which was lowered, I believe, in 2022 from 7 down to 6.75. And then lastly, I would just say that we feel like the liquidity profile, where you have about 17% in private markets through real estate and infrastructure, is reasonable given your cash flow situation. Again, I'll show support for all of these takeaways, but that's kind of the high level. Any thoughts or questions before we get into it? Okay, so I'm going to move kind of quick through this some of this introductory stuff, since you we're a little bit behind time, and you've seen some of these things before, where we talked about what our process was going to be. This page, I think the key thing to know on this is the goal here is to establish your long-term asset allocation policy with a consideration of how that impacts the liabilities, contributions, and those sorts of things. So that's kind of the focus for the day. In order to do that, on the next slide, we look at the interaction of these policies. So typically, Cowen's purview is this blue circle, the investment policy. But we're going to pull in information from your actuary on the funding policy and the benefits policy. So what are the current assets that you have earning? And then what's the money coming in and what's the money going out? That's where we're wrapping all of that together. And the idea is, of course, with an asset, pairing the assets and liabilities, you want this this equation at the bottom to balance out, where contributions plus investment earnings on the assets you have at least equals the benefits going out plus any other expenses going out. And in the case where you're underfunded and you need to make up some of that gap, you actually want the left-hand side to be greater than the right-hand side. So it's good that, you know, we expect a higher return on your assets than the actuarial assumption of 675. On the next slide, yeah. So I just really want to be clear that we're using our asset capital market assumptions. You see that on the top left of this page. And we're using your actuary GRS's data on the liability. So we're not coming up with our own liability estimate. We're using GRS data, matching to them. And then we take those two things together and we start simulating different potential outcomes, given that, you know, things don't always go perfectly in the markets, right? There's volatility in the markets. So we start simulating that. But I just want to be clear that we're not doing our own liability calculations. We are using your actuary's data on that. And then, yeah, lastly, in terms of intro, I think, we've talked about these capital market assumptions before. I just want to highlight these are the assumptions that go into projecting the returns on different total portfolio mixes. So the asset classes that are being considered are highlighted here. I think you've seen this before. I think maybe the most notable thing is that core fixed income line kind of in the middle of the page. You see our current expected return is 5.25. And that's up from 1.75 just a couple of years ago. So Gordy mentioned, I think it was Gordy, might have been Craig, about how, you know, fixed income returns have been challenged because rates have moved up so much. The positive to that is that now that rates are higher, we expect higher returns going forward. So you've suffered some difficult performance, but that means going forward, you have a higher yield on that, on that allocation, and therefore a higher expected return going forward. Any thoughts or questions on the assumptions? Okay. So looking at your current portfolio on slide 10, we kind of talked about this before as well, but your current policy just at a broad level, 58% public equity, 25% fixed income, and then 17% in private markets through real estate and infrastructure. And when you put all that together using the assumptions that we had on the prior page, you see that that's how we get to that expected return of 7.3% for this mix of assets. And then the expected risk is defined by standard deviation, or really we think of that as kind of the uncertainty around that expected return, is 11.8%. And then we use the most recent actuarial valuation as our starting point. So that was June 30th of 2023. And so at the time, the market value of assets was $906 million. I know you're up to $954 now. The actuarial value of assets, so they're smoothing. So they're kind of not reflecting the full losses that were experienced in 2022. So you see that value is $946 million. But then the liability is the same under both. And so that means from a market perspective, your funded status was about 72% and the actuarial funded status was 75%. That's the starting point for this study. And then we sort of project forward from there. Yeah, I'll move to slide 12. So we already talked about a lot of these assumptions on this page, the funded status that you see here. I just want to reiterate again, we're using data from GRS and then we're kind of matching to their project or their liability estimate. And then we project forward from there. But the other thing I want to point out again on here is this, the assumptions that we use for the employer contribution. So we assume that 27.5% of pay is fixed unless the, you know, in the simulations or the projections, unless you reach full funding. So this is again, based on the actuarial assumption that you contribute that 27.5% of pay, and then once you reach full funding, it reverts to just contributing the actuarially determined contribution, so kind of the minimum required contribution. And so that's kind of a key component here because you have a really strong cash flow profile based on this strong contribution that you all have approved. And then at the bottom of the page, just reiterating, you know, the actuary's assumption is 6.75 on the assets and liabilities, but we have a projection of 7.34, and we use our projection 7.34 as we go through this study on the assets. So you get that gap, in the expectation of the growth on the assets over the liability as we go through the study here. So this section here, we're doing some projections with no variability. So this just assumes that any of our asset assumptions and any of GRS's liability assumptions come to fruition perfectly. One of the things we assume is a constant active membership. So if anyone leaves the plan, an active member leaves, you just replace them with one. So it's a one in, one out, leaves a pretty stable active versus inactive member profile and a pretty stable average age of active in the plan. So that's pretty stable. Next slide. Let me actually move forward one more. So assuming you get that 7.34% return every year without fail, so there's no variability assumed here, and then using the projections for the liability based on the 6.75% growth of the liability, you would get to full funded 10 years from now. So you go from the current about 72% funded up to 100% funded in 10 years. That's, again, assuming you get 7.34% every year without fail. But that's a good place to be, right? If you get something close to our expected return, you would be fully funded 10 years from now. Now, again, that is based also on the assumption of the cash flows, which we show on the next slide. So here, you know, again, just kind of highlighting the contribution policy of that 27.5%, you see that because of that, as the assets are growing, the actual outflow as a percentage of assets is falling for most of this period. And the way we calculate the outflows is the benefit payments that are going out, plus any expenses going out, and then you subtract out the contributions coming from both the employer and employee. And that leads to, you know, a pretty reasonable cash outflow of 2-3% per year. You see at the last year that jump in the net outflows. That's because in our projections, you get to full funded, and so you're not contributing as much. And so the outflow looks a little bit higher. But that's, again, because the contributions fall off, which would be, in theory, a good thing because you'd be fully funded at that point. But this is a key component of all of the projections, so I want to make sure that's clear. So stop me if anyone has questions on that. Okay. So let's move into some simulated results on the next slide. So what we do here is, you know, in those few slides I just showed, I said we just assume no variability, that all of our assumptions come to fruition. Now we start varying things like the asset returns, interest rates, inflation, and kind of see what's the range of potential outcomes when we look at the different variables, assets, liabilities, those sorts of things. And so this section, we're just looking at year by year, the projection on your current target allocation. And so in most of these slides, we highlight the median, that's the 50th percentile. So that's kind of the expected case outcome. And then we also highlight the 97.5th percentile. So we call that a downside or a worst case outcome. Think of that as like a two standard deviation bad market environment where in the median case, you see the assets go from a little over 900 million to in 2033 over 1.3 billion. But if we had a bad market environment for that 10 years, a two standard deviation event bad market environment, that could drop to as low as 672. So we always kind of think of the trade-off between, you know, the downside risk versus the expected case. But in the expected case, the assets are expected to grow net of cash flows by about 3.8% per year. So that's the 7.3% investment return, but taking out any of the outflows that are going out of the plan. On the next slide, we do the same thing for the liabilities. And we keep these two charts on the same scale to show that, you know, there's a lot more variability on the assets than there is on the liabilities. And that's where you get potential risk on your funded status, right? So with the liability, really the only variability that we have here is inflation, which, so if you change inflation, that flows through to compensation of the members, and then that flows through, of course, to the liability that you owe them. In the median case, the liability is expected to go from about 1.3 billion to just under 1.4. And so that's, in the median case, only a 0.9% annual growth. So obviously, with the assets expected to grow 3.8% in the median and the liability only 0.9, that's how you get to, you know, an expectation of the funded status improving. But you see again here, you know, if you had a really inflationary environment, the liability could go up to almost 1.5 billion. So you see that the difference there, it's not as wide as the assets, but there is variability there as well. And then on the next slide, when you put the assets and the liabilities together, this shows you the range of potential funded status levels that you might achieve, again, for your current target allocation. And so we start with that 72% market-based funded status based on your most recent actuarial study. And then we project forward from there. And so you see here in the median case in 2033, the expectation is that you're 96% funded. So before, when there was no variability and we assume you get 7.3% every year without fail, I said you get to fully funded in 2033. Now you're just shy of that at 96%. And so you can think of that as what we call volatility drag. So once there's uncertainty in the markets, it tends to, you know, pull the total return down a little bit. So you don't get to quite 100, but you're pretty close at 96%. And then you see the probability of being fully funded there is 45. So usually we're looking for 50%, which would mean in the expected case, you're fully funded. You're just below that with this target allocation. And then, of course, we highlight the potential downside where the funded status could fall to 49% as well. And then one last thing for the current target projections. This shows the range of net outflows using that same formula where it's benefit payments plus expenses going out and then contributions coming in. And then we do this kind of stoplight color, which is not really a formula per se. It's just kind of based on our experience with clients on what level of outflows is manageable. And essentially, even in the worst case scenarios here where assets are down and you still have the same amount of money going out, everything is 7% or less in outflows. So we think that your liquidity profile is reasonable. So your current allocation to, you know, more illiquid areas like real estate and an infrastructure is certainly manageable. Okay, so that was a lot on your current allocation. Any questions on that information before we get into comparing other mixes? Okay, so I showed for your current allocation that we actually model this year by year for 10 years. Now what we're going to do is just kind of compare that final 10th year across these different potential allocation mixes. And so what we did is we looked at mixes in ranges of 5% fixed income. So you see your current target's at 25. We have one that's more aggressive down to 20% fixed income. And then the other ones to the left of it are less aggressive going from 30 all the way up to 40% fixed income. I did want to point out we kept real estate capped at 12%, so we didn't want to go above where you're currently at. And then we kept private infrastructure just flat at 5%. So really kind of the trade-off is mostly between fixed income and equities. But what you see, the expected returns here, even the least, you know, the most conservative mix of 40% fixed income is expected to return about 7%, which is still ahead of that 675 required return. So all of these mixes are viable candidates for consideration in our view. And that's kind of why we lean towards staying where you're at or maybe moving left on this chart to something with a little bit more fixed income because they're all expected to achieve or exceed that 6.75% return. On the next slide, so of course, you know, there's variability with expected returns just like there is with assets and liabilities and all those things. So we show here the potential range of returns around that expected number that we just showed on the last page. And you can see kind of as you move from left to right, you're getting to more aggressive mixes with more equity and less fixed income. So you can see that the expected returns get higher, but the range widens. So essentially to get more return, you have less certainty or more risk as we think about it. But really, you know, we plot what's the probability of all of these mixes achieving 675, and they're all above 50%. So all of them, again, would achieve your goals according to that, you know, that 675 return target. So again, for all of these mixes, we simulate the potential range of assets just like we did for your current target. And then we compare that to the range of potential liability outcomes. And then we plot what's the potential funded status for these different mixes. And again, we're looking at the median case and then the downside. And so we kind of think of this as a bit of a trade-off. You know, how much downside are you willing to risk to pursue a higher median? Because as you go from left to right, you take, you get more aggressive mixes. The median case improves for the most part, but the downside gets worse, right? The range gets wider and the potential downside gets worse. So it's kind of that trade-off of, again, how much are we willing to risk on the downside to get a better median? And then when we're thinking about the trade-off between mixes, you know, it's kind of, is it favorable, the median versus downside? So for example, if you look on here, if you go from TSRS target to 30% fixed income, at least when you round it, it's the same median expected funded status of 96. But on the downside, the 30% fixed income holds up better. So you're at 51% funded instead of 49. So that would be a favorable trade-off, right? Where you're not giving up as much in the median as you're gaining in the potential downside protection. I think I'll skip the next one and just go to the following. So we do this same projection for contributions. This is cumulative contributions over 10 years. And, you know, really in the median case and even the downside 97.5, there's not a lot of difference between mixes. And that's because you have such a strong contribution policy that you don't see contributions having to change much. Really where you see the biggest change is if a given mix achieves full funding sooner. So you actually see that the positive cases, the above median cases, the 25th percentile and the 2.5th percentile. So that's if you had really strong markets. That's where you see the biggest difference between these mixes. Because the more aggressive you would be, the more likely you are to get to full funding. But again, you're potentially risking the downside to get there. And then finally, so, you know, one cost to the plan is contributions, but another cost is how much do you still owe? How much of the liability is still unfunded 10 years from now? So ultimate net cost covers both of those. So it's how much have I paid over 10 years plus what do I still owe 10 years from now? And here again, you see that as you get more aggressive, you know, your cost declines in the median case, but it can get worse in a bad market environment, the 97.5. And I think I'll just go to 31 and kind of summarize. You know, I went through that data quickly because we have a slide just after this one that really kind of highlights the differences between these mixes. But just to summarize our findings as we went through all this data and to spare you having to look at every number yourself, all of these mixes that we evaluated are projected to exceed that 6.75% actuarially assumed return. The funded status is expected to improve over the next 10 years under all of these mixes. A lot of that is from your strong contribution policy. And then, you know, more aggressive mixes do have a more favorable median expectation, but they also tend to have a worse downside. So that's the trade-off. That's true for funded status and ultimate net cost. But when it comes to contributions, there's not as much of a difference between them because, again, you're contributing more than the minimum required. So you don't often see contributions having to ratchet up if an aggressive mix has a bad market environment. But in terms of our thoughts on how you should take all this data and what you should do with it, you know, we think with a strong contribution policy and that all the returns are expected to exceed the required return, you can either maintain your current exposure or we would consider increasing your exposure to fixed income if you're going to move. And so again, that trade-off is, you know, if you add fixed income, you kind of give up some expected benefit in the median, but you get an improvement in the downside. So on the next slide, we're going to compare your current target to the difference if you were to move to any of these other potential mixes that have more fixed income. So we didn't consider getting more aggressive. We don't think you need to do that. But if you're going to move, I think maybe that far right column, the 30% fixed income, might be something worth considering. So you see there the change in the allocation. You're adding 5% to fixed income funded from a little bit of equity and a little bit of real estate. But you see that the trade-off in the expected return is there. It's a positive trade-off. So you give up, you know, 0.1% in expected return, but the standard deviation or volatility falls by 0.7. So you get a better risk-adjusted return or Sharpe ratio from that. The trade-off is also positive for the funded ratio. So like in the median case, again, looking at that far right column, if you move to that mix, you know, you give up 0.3% expectation in funded status, but on the downside, you gain 1.8%. So we just think that, again, that trade-off is there. And it's kind of similar, like I said, contributions is not as different between the mixes, but the ultimate net cost is kind of similar where the gain on downside protection is better than the give up in the median expectation. So we think it's worth considering, you know, if you're either staying where you are or maybe considering that far right 30% fixed income mix. And so there, that I went through that quickly, but that was kind of the comments I wanted to make, and then just thought I would open it up to questions or discussion.
Are there any questions?
Go ahead.
You can't seem to hear you, Art.
Gordy, it's not just you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. What I was going to, this all presumes that the board reaffirmed their commitment to real estate, right? Because we had that as a sort of an ongoing discussion that we were waiting to see, and the board gave direction to Callan to model real estate under our current allocation in this model. So I think it's an important reminder for the board that this presumes that we would be going reallocating the dollars from JP Morgan, both of JP Morgan's accounts to another real estate manager. And I want to just make sure the board.
That's a good reminder, Art. Yes, you know, we've talked about private real estate. The board at our last quarterly meeting said that, yes, we want to see some real estate in the allocations. And so we modeled it accordingly, as Art said. But, you know, here we're focused on the total asset allocation. The next piece of this is, you know, once you select that asset allocation is how do you want to invest the real estate dollars? So that's will be a future discussion. But, you know, overarching all of this, you know, TSRS has had really good success from a performance perspective over long periods of time. You've met your objectives. The difference that we see with your plan versus others is your really strong employer contribution. Right, the 27.5%, and that's been in place for a while, and we know it's very powerful to help close this funding gap. And so, part of looking at this, you know, higher allocation to fixed income is that you do have that money coming in. It's by itself going to start to, you know, close some of the funding gap because it's higher than what's perhaps you would need to stay at your current funded status. So, you know, because of that. Is there the ability to take a little bit of volatility off the table? And clearly we think that there is, right? It's just, you know, do you want to stay where you are, or does it make sense to, you know, with the higher yields in fixed income, you know, adjust that allocation a little bit?
And if I can just add in there, the mayor and council have continued to be very supportive of that 27.5%. But we've been in a few good budget cycle years where there hasn't been necessarily any downward pressure on the general fund. And I believe that's going to change over the course of the next 3 fiscal years. You know, there is going to be a proposal here in the next week to mayor and council about potentially doing a half cent sales tax to fund a bunch of different initiatives. But with the state moving to the flat tax, at least in the short term, there might be some pressure on the, there's undoubtedly going to be some pressure on the general fund. And I'm not clear on what that might mean for that 27.5%. I think the city manager's office continues to support that number. But, you know, one can never know when we're competing for priorities. So not something that I want to necessarily worry the board about, but I think it should be in the back of our minds as we, you know, look at this potential mix moving forward for over the course of the next 5 years.
That's helpful. Thanks, Art. Our modeling was done based on 27.5. And so if that number is to change, right, that's a meaningful number. We would suggest, you know, taking a look at the allocation again. But right now, we're just operating under sort of the status quo, if you will.
Yeah. And I think I would add certainly the magnitude of any changes would matter a lot for these numbers. But one of the things that does give us a little bit of comfort is every single return, expected return, is above the actuarial assumption. So, you know, barring a major, major change, you know, it's likely you would continue to still close that funding gap because the allocations are expected to return more than the actuary is expected.
I just, this is Kevin. I appreciate the presentation. Very thorough, lots of information. I just want to follow up a little bit more in terms of what Art was referencing in terms of the city. And I guess when I was looking at this thing the other day, I see that probably as, I mean, we're going to have market risk. But I sense at least a risk we got to be aware of, and it's being discussed here. It's just how much the city contributes. I think your presentation, and you guys have pointed out, it's a key assumption.
Yeah.
I think the math behind it, I think the city over this 10-year period is going to contribute close to, you know, $500 million. I'm trying to recall, and that's when they contributed 27.5%. I think if they contributed, and it's been a while since I've looked at the actuarial amounts that are required, but I think that their required amount is maybe, I think it may only be like 21%. Yeah, okay, 21%. So that gets to be, well, let's say that the city roughly today is putting in $45 million. And if for, you know, whatever reason is Art's indicating, or let's say that the economy gets tougher and they just don't have the amount of sales tax revenues and other things coming in the door, that now instead of them contributing, you know, 27.5%, you know, for rough math, assume it's close to 50 million. If it dropped to 22%, you're taking out 10 million a year. Or again, this is really kind of simple math, but over 10 years, obviously that's $100 million. So, and I think that they, you know, they're in the position, and it's been great that they've supported this plan. I think it's important that they support the plan. But, you know, they start to have pressures that they got to have other things that are funded. And then let's say we did have a recession and they just don't have the level of revenues coming in. This would be one spot, at least if I were in their role, I might look to say, boy, I need a little extra help somewhere. So given that explanation, if, you know, we assigned, you know, some risk to that to better protect ourselves. And again, we got close to $70 million of payments we got to make every single year. And obviously if the city doesn't contribute as much as they are currently, then it's got to be made up by basically sales of portfolio assets. So liquidity has always kind of been a concern to mine. You know, just in overall scheme of things, as we have that high $70 million that has to be paid out. So with that background, and this, you know, I'm certainly you can question my assumptions or my thought process, but if that is the situation, you know, at least that risk is sitting out there, and I think you guys agree with it, how would you change the portfolio to address that potential risk in terms of the asset?
Yeah, and we've thought about that a lot, but of course it's not our purview to decide, you know, what the contribution policy is going to be, which is why we didn't model any different ones. But I think that your liquidity position would still not be a concern to me. I mean, relative to other clients that we work with and studies that we do, I think 17%, especially with core real estate in most environments being, you know, fairly liquid. I know right now is an exception to that. So the liquidity side of what you just said is not something that I think would have to change dramatically from the mixes that we looked at. I think the question becomes, you know, then do you feel like obligated to take more investment risk to get a higher return and close that funding gap through investment returns? And so that to me is kind of how I would think about it is, does that mean then that we want to stay where we're at and achieve a higher return so that we can make up for any potential decline in contributions? You know, I think maybe we'd have to model how much worse those outflows get, but in the baseline, you know, a net outflow of you're about 3% in the median. So that obviously would drop if you didn't have as much contributions, but I think I would guess, go to 6 or 7 maybe, but still a low percentage net outflow. So I think the liquidity for me is less of a concern than the question of, do you then feel obligated to achieve, you know, pursue a higher return to close the funding gap instead?
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. That makes sense.
Let me follow on Kevin's comment. It occurs to me that, and nothing is guaranteed, but it seems like if we got to a point where the city was contributing less because of financial pressure, it's more than plausible that that could tie into a recession, which would potentially tie into market conditions that gave us a smaller asset base than we would otherwise have. So it's not as if these issues are totally disaggregated one from the other. Something like a whirlpool effect occurs to me, and I think it's at least worth thinking about. I don't know whether we tell you to go back and assume 25% or 24% or, you know, what we do, but I think we ought to be conscious of the fact that we've had a very nice run and there's no guarantee that this will continue. And if it doesn't continue, chances are we'll get hit from multiple directions.
Yeah. Okay, so what I also want to remind the board is if I can take you back to last year and maybe even the year before that, when Dana and GRS comes in and they give their annual presentation, we've talked for a couple of years now about intentionally sort of quote unquote landing that plane, with the employer contribution. In addition to what maybe my perception is of the 27.5% and the risk that's associated there, and that's not including recessionary factors, that's just knowing the state flat tax and the impact that that's going to have on the city revenue base over the course of the next 3 fiscal years that's been outlined by the city manager's office, both in last budget cycle and in the one that we're sort of already preparing for FY26, you know, the board did talk about, sort of intentionally, you know, landing that 27.5 plane so there's not a cliff. Now, maybe that's not going to happen in the next 5 years, so it's less of a concern. But as we get closer to that 100% funded status, there is going to be a point where I do think that the board is likely going to say, here, city, you can, because when it gets down to the ARC or the annual required contribution getting into 17%, I don't know that we're going to continue to say you have to give us 27.5%, right? So there has been that discussion, and I want to just make sure we're thinking about it from all different perspectives and all different angles.
Yeah, you know, I remember that too. But I think the assumption that has been made is, you know, it's a good assumption, and it's the appropriate assumption for this type of forecast. But I agree, Art. I think as we get closer to full funding, it's not going to be just a step function where suddenly we go from 27.5% to 21. I think aside from the city considerations for budget pressures, they'll just start to glide path that thing down. The forecast doesn't include that. I don't think that's really important. I mean, I think it's, we can just keep it in the back of our head. It has some impact. And obviously, you know, if we start to get concerned about liquidity, in terms of just the amount of contributions the city's sending in, you know, we can start to modify our portfolio at that point in time. I guess what I was thinking, you know, in terms of some of the information you provided, talks about a little bit higher allocation for bonds. And to me, it's much easier to step into the bond market now than it was 5 years ago, the last time we looked at this thing, or 3 years ago. So, you know, I guess when I think of this potential liquidity issue, and I see it, and I appreciate your comments, you see it as low risk, and I generally see it as low risk as well. But it's one of those things that if it ever pops up, it gets to be a real annoying issue and difficult issue sometimes to work through. So, with all, and I'm sorry to go on and on, but I kind of think when I looked at your reallocations, I said, I would probably move a little bit more towards fixed income, in part just for more, you know, yes, you reduce the volatility of your return in your portfolio, but I would see it that as providing us a little bit more liquidity, assuming that we're in high quality bonds and especially the treasuries and the market. We have a recession, the economy tanks, the market tanks, everything kind of goes down. Most likely investors are going to run to treasuries. So if we need liquidity, one, we'll pick up some market gains, at least on the treasury part of that portfolio, but it'd also be a source for liquidity if we needed it because the city is being pinched in terms of their ability to fund all their needs and requirements. And so long-winded discussion where at least I'm kind of thinking, maybe we should increase the allocation of fixed income, you know, for a combination of reasons, including, at least from my perspective, liquidity.
Any other comments, questions?
I guess I just have a clarifying question for Callan. Are you asking the board to provide direction on this today, or?
That was our understanding.
Okay. Yeah. I thought so. I want to make it clear to the board.
I was about to ask the same question.
I think I would add, though, if you're not comfortable making a decision today, which would be our preference, we can certainly discuss it again at a future meeting.
How many board members do we have now? Do we have five on the call?
Yes, sir. The only one missing is Jeff Whiting.
Okay. All right. I was concerned that maybe we were – I'm not – my screen doesn't have everybody on it anymore because of what's showing. And the action item would be approving the asset liability study, correct? Or adopting it?
So
the action would be to either adopt, make no changes to the current allocation, or to adopt one of the allocations that's been presented, whether it's a 35 or a 30% allocation to fixed income, or a 40% allocation to fixed income, or a 35% allocation to fixed income, or do nothing and say we want to hold firm on our current allocation.
What's the pleasure of the board? Do y'all want to have a motion and take care of this, or do you think we were late in the morning and we should we do this? We don't have a time pressure at this point, correct?
A time pressure from the meeting perspective?
We can do this next month without any problems, correct?
I believe that's accurate, yes.
Okay. What what's the pleasure? Does somebody want to make a motion, or do you think we should bring this up in September?
My preference would, I can't raise my hand because I'm on the phone. This is Jim. My preference would be for Kevin to craft a presentation for us to vote on right now.
How do you feel about that, Kevin?
I'm sorry. He wants me to propose a motion? Is that what he's saying?
I believe that's what he's saying.
Okay. I guess I'm sure I'm willing to do that. I mean, I've just kind of looked at this stuff today, and you know, we haven't heard much feedback from others in terms of risk and allocation to you know, fixed income and stuff. But
let me make an executive decision and suggest that we bring this back next month. It's a big deal. Does that work for you, Art?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm flexible, and I think Callan has indicated they're comfortable coming back next month.
Yeah. Okay. Let's do that. We've been at this now 2.5 hours, and I think this is a big deal issue, and the notion that we're going to quickly throw something together is not optimum to me. Anybody got major heartburn over that?
No, that's fine with me.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question of the board? Is there any other analysis as it relates to this particular topic that the board is asking for Callan to bring back, or are we just going to revisit this exact topic next month? I want to be able to provide the board with whatever analysis is needed to get to a decision next month.
I don't need anything else. I just think we'll do a better job with this if we're a little fresher.
Yeah, and Art, I don't need any additional information. I think they provided they provided a great presentation. You know, I would have a question just in terms of, am I thinking about it right? Am I missing something? If I say, well, if you got a higher allocation of fixed income, that may give you better access to liquidity, you know, in a troubled time. And I could be thinking about it wrong, but confirmation, or at least the pluses and minuses of that view, I'd appreciate that. Either, you know, you don't have to do it today, but maybe Gordy can touch on it, or you guys can touch on it today, or, you know, the meeting September, I guess it would be.
Yeah, it's always useful to have dry powder, to have treasuries in a flight to quality type environment. The situation you're in is that you have you're in funds with your core bonds, right? And so they wouldn't be able to explicitly sell treasuries to give you cash, but they could sell units basically of the core product to give you cash. Yeah. We think your cash profiles, your liquidity profile is strong. And of course you don't want to sell equities in a down market, but if you had to, you could. And your fixed income is liquid enough that you could draw on it to make benefit payments if needed. But overall, from a long-term perspective, you know, we see clients that have 10, 15, 20, 25% in private equity, for example, that you can't touch at all. And that's when liquidity becomes an issue, when you're really dealing with, you know, say 3/4 of the portfolio, trying to drum up some liquidity in a tough market. We don't think that that's going to be a challenge.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for the response and the information, guys.
Yep.
All right. Thank you all for an excellent presentation this morning. I think if you need to move on, great. But Art, it looks like the next item is the J.P. Morgan fee credit program, and I know Callan has involvement with that. So do you want to update us on that?
Yeah, this dates back to, I believe it was our June meeting where Callan brought to the table a fee credit program that JP Morgan is offering. If we agree to maintain 20% at least in the queue, from a redemption perspective, and they would, I think it's a 30 basis point drop in our fee. I committed that we would talk with staff to ensure that we could manage this from a staffing perspective and bring that back to the board. We have made the decision to participate in the fee credit program. What that essentially means for us is we'll be in the redemption queue longer than maybe we would otherwise. And I think over the 18-month period that they're offering it, it'll save us about $180,000 in fees as a result of the fee credit. And it'll just take us that much longer to get full redemption from JP Morgan in both of our funds that are held with them. So we will communicate that to JP Morgan by the end of the month as required. And we'll just want to let the board know that we made that decision with consultation from Callan, and then more importantly, talking with staff to make sure we could, from a staff perspective, manage that. And we can, we feel confident that we can, and we're going to move in that direction. So it's just really an update for the board.
Okay. The disability code updates, Art or Cassie?
Yeah. No, that's me. I put this on the agenda as a placeholder because I thought there might be some additional conversation from the board as it relates to the disability code language that has been updated, and that I heard at the last meeting we maybe want to revisit, and I'm not sure if the board wanted to revisit the language as it relates to earnings or in light of today's discussion. So it was just a placeholder. If the board does want to have that discussion now, happy to do it. I'm feeling like we're 2.5 hours in. We might want to kick this to the next meeting so that it's a little bit more fresh. And if we want to revisit those code updates in their entirety, we can bring that back and determine it if and where might be an appropriate place to make any additional revisions based upon what the board heard this morning.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be a good idea to take one more look at the code updates that the board has already discussed, and I think that there are a couple clarifications that I could work with Pete and Dawn on that disability review process that we went through this morning. So if the board is amenable, I would suggest that we bring that back in September for a last look.
Yeah, I like that idea. I certainly don't want to have another meeting like the meeting we had today. I've only got two topics from today on for next month. Are we overloading an agenda for next month, Art? Or
no, sir. We can fit it in.
Okay, great. I think we learned about an issue that is a bit of a surprise that it didn't come up in the past, but it certainly. I had a friend many years ago who knew a lawyer who said every element of the Uniform Commercial Code is a case gone wrong. So we can always learn from the things we've done and language issues. But I'd like to, if we've gone to all of this effort, and it has been a lot of worthy effort, let's make sure that we get it finalized to take into account everything we know as of now. Okay. Anything else for today? Anything else, Art?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the agenda.
All right. Do I hear a motion to adjourn? Oh, did we get Mr. Is it Ibiza? Did we get Mr. Ibiza's identifying information?
Yeah, it's on his it's on his name, yeah.
Okay, great. All right. Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved,
Mrs. Salsa.
Thank you. Is there a second? we had Kevin and Elsa. So
I had Kevin and Elsa.
Pick them. Okay. Pick your order.
Mr. Chairman, I was informed in another board meeting that on matters of this nature, we can just vote. I don't have to call the roll. So.
Oh. Great. All those in favor of adjourning, that's just for things like adjourning. We still need to call the vote for substantive matters. All right. All those in favor of saying goodbye, say aye.
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 Anybody want to stick around for a while? All right. Hearing that, nothing. Let's call it a day. We'll see you next month. Thank you for a lot of hard work this morning. And thank you, Cal.
All right. Take care.
For all your efforts. Take care.
Good seeing everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye.